This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Music as a form of protest has a long history. It goes back to the colonial period in America. It continues through the abolition movement and beyond, and it has strong roots here in North Carolina. On today's program, the history of protest music in the state. We're going to start in the 1920s and 30s, where worker strikes at textile mills sparked a new kind of protest movement and music to go with it. Joining me now is Vincent Rochinio. He is a sociology professor at Ohio State University, and he's co-authored the book The Voice of Southern Labor, Radio, Music, and Textile Strikes. Vincent Rochinio, welcome to the State of Things.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Tell us what was going on in the 1920s and 30s that went hand in hand with the rise in this music.
Yeah, there was actually a lot going on in the 1920s and 30s that we tend not to think about or that are not part of common knowledge. A couple of things in particular. First of all, 500,000 Southern textile workers went on strike. That's sort of a big story that many people don't know about. But simultaneous to that, there were technological innovations going on in the United States, including the advent and spread of radio stations for the first time. There was a burgeoning recording industry and a recording industry and radio stations that were looking for entertainment. And they often found this entertainment in the very mill villages of places like Gastonia, North Carolina, Burlington, Marion, North Carolina.
All right, well, let's talk about, pull those threads apart one at a time, the changes in technology and speed-ups in the mills. Talk about what was happening and the impact that had on workers.
Sure. The work lives of mills were changing drastically. These were, you know, largely folks that were farmers prior to the growth of mill villages. Concentrated populations were coming out of the mountains to work these jobs in the mills, which seemed like more stable employment. And, you know, there were some upsides to it, to urbanization, like electricity and things like that. But what these mill workers found over time is that mill owners were speeding up the process, what workers themselves called the stretch out, which means one worker working more machines and also working extraordinarily long shifts, you know, 12-hour shifts and half a day on Saturday, et cetera. That combined with the fact that they weren't getting paid so much and they were often, you know, having to pay for their groceries with company script at the company store, put many of them in the hole. So what started out as an interesting opportunity for many became a really difficult work life and family life, because in fact it was often husband and wife working in the mill, as well as children as young as 8 or 9 years old legally, but we know that there were 6, 7 year olds working in the mills as well.
And one of the outlets for this increased stress was music and songwriting, right?
For sure. I mean, some of the sort of early voices across Southern radio and within the recording industry were mill workers themselves. And what was so interesting about these workers and the music they generated is it communicated in a way that maybe American music had not heard before, details of the very struggles that mill workers were experiencing in their lives, and just the struggle, paycheck to paycheck, feeding and taking care of your kids, et cetera.
Let's hear an example of that. This is Dave McCarron, and it's a song called The Cotton Mill Colic.
When you buy clothes on easy terms, the collectors treat you like measly worms. $1 down, and then Lord knows if you don't make a payment, they'll take your clothes. When you go to bed, you can't sleep. You owe so much at the end of the week. No use to collect, they're all that way, pecking at your door till they get your pay. I'm a gonna starve, everybody will, cause you can't make a living at a cotton mill.
There's a cotton mill colic, or at least a clip from David McCarron in the 1930s. I'm talking to Vincent Rochinio, who is joining us to talk about protest music. He's written a book on that, Textile Mills in North Carolina. And this music, there it is. It couldn't be any more clear. Interestingly enough, same problems today, keeping workers, keeping, you know, sort of working folks in debt, keeping them in prison these days, and stretching out the work, productivity at the cost of workers, all of that. But in the songs of these folks who really weren't professional songwriters, before this, I guess.
No. I mean, well, that you know, there was a strong tradition, of course, you know, coming out of the mountains, the Piedmont of North Carolina and certain areas of South Carolina, strong musical traditions, you know, in terms of family life and community life. And they brought that to the mill villages with them. But what's so fascinating about this body of music that emerges, including, you know, maybe including Dave McCarn's work for sure, is the way they capture, you know, real lived experiences on the job. I mean, Dave McCarn was a mill worker when he wrote this song. He left for a short time because he thought he maybe had a musical career. But after he published that song, he was afraid he wouldn't be able to get a job in the mill again. I mean, these were, in some ways, it was a very radical thing to do, to sort of challenge the prevailing order of things. But he did it in such a way, and a number of these musicians did it in such a way, that they really tapped into a whole population's work and family lives in the South.
Let's talk about that tapping in, because it's one thing to write a lament like that sitting on your porch, quite another to share it. And the innovation, as you talked about, of radio played a big part in spreading the word, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, radio, the emergence of radio stations in states like North Carolina in the early 20s and through the mid 30s especially, had sort of a phenomenal effect in different ways. One is it gave some of these mill workers the opportunity to sort of strike out, to escape mill life. And in fact, a number of the songs talk about sort of finding a better day somehow, somewhere, a new occupation. So it provided opportunity in that way, but it did something even more important, which was it connected otherwise dispersed mill communities now through the airwaves. You know, workers in Burlington, North Carolina, could hear the same music as you know, workers in Hickory or Charlotte or Gastonia, for that matter. It sort of connected, created a sort of a cultural conduit whereby these experiences were shared more widely than just that singular little mill village.
And of course, radio stations, as they emerge, desperate for content, so they're putting on everything they can possibly get, and this stuff is in the air, right? Literally.
It's not in the air, but it's also a smart move by early radio station owners, because they knew they wanted to appeal to local populations. And what a better way to appeal to a local population than put on somebody that people know and somebody that would sing music that could speak to their actual lives.
Well, I wanted to talk about balladeer and labor organizer, somebody we've talked about on this show before, Ella Mae Wiggins, because she plays an important part of this. Tell us about her and her role in all of this.
Yeah. You know, some of the musicians that emerged during this time period were striking out to become musicians. And then some of the balladeers that emerge in the movement of Southern textile workers in the 1920s and 1930s don't necessarily have that goal, but they just have a gift for melody, for lyric, etc. Ella Mae Wiggins was a mill worker, mill mother in Gastonia, working at the Luray Mill. Several of her children had died of pellagra, of poverty, essentially, and malnutrition. And as workers started to galvanize around the factory there, she put her feelings to tunes in a way that really captivated her fellow workers in the area. And like McCarn, but maybe sort of deeper to the heart, she spoke about what it was like to be a parent and a mother in particular. And her song, Mill Mother's Lament, became a classic. It still tugs at the heartstrings, as it should for any mother out there listening. And Ella Mae Wiggins ultimately was killed by a mill-sponsored mob during the strikes in Gastonia, and became a martyr and a sort of symbol of everyday people struggling to do a little bit better for their children. And nothing captures that better than Mill Mother's Lament.
We leave our homes in the morning. We kiss our children goodbye. While we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocery bills to pay, not a cent to spend for clothing, not a cent to lay away.
That's Pete Seeger singing the song Mill Mother's Lament, written by Ella Mae Wiggins. My guest is Vincent Rocinio, who joins us to talk about that. He's a professor at Ohio State University and co-author of the book The Voice of Southern Labor. You talked about the fact that she was killed, that Gastonia strike ended in violence. There was a strike in the early 30s mm-hmm. as well that was pretty amazing because essentially mill workers organized it themselves. The unions had to come down kind of almost after the fact and catch up, right?
That was sort of one of the most interesting things about the striking Southern textile workers is in some ways unions had given up on them. They had very few organizers in the South, but these people kind of revolted of their own accord.
And what about the music? What happens? Because I know in the aftermath of that strike in the early 30s, the labor movement is more or less dead. The violence that the owners used to repress worker rights pretty much dampened any enthusiasm for more mm-hmm. for more protest. What happens to the music after that?
Well, you know, some of the musicians toned down their messages a little. Some went back to work in the mills. The Dixon brothers, Dorsey and Howard Dixon, who were just incredible musicians of the time and played the airwaves and barnstormed mill towns, eventually went back to the mills after cutting a couple of records. It's also the case that, you know, following these strikes and maybe in response to these strikes, state governments were pressuring the federal government for tighter FCC involvement over what could be broadcast over the airwaves. And what were autonomous radio stations all of a sudden had to worry about their licenses being revoked if anything that could be deemed radical, political messages were aired. So that kind of shut the door on some of the potentially politically explicitness of some of these songs. Now the music lives on; it doesn't go away. Once it's in the ether, once it's been recorded, people pick up on it. So of course, you know, we have Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and Alan Lomax, where folks like that were able to capture these songs and sort of preserve them. And there have been re-recordings of these songs over time, and I think we're starting to actually rediscover them. Because some of the lyrics, the struggles, working class struggles that people go through are no less relevant today, maybe even increasingly relevant.
Would you say that they have a genealogy and that we're rediscovering those songs today, but is some of their DNA in the protest music of 2017?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, it's sort of amazing that, you know, certainly in the case of Southern textile mill workers, some themes, I mean, they were borrowing some of the tunes from old, you know, Southern North Carolinian sort of porch music and just setting those tunes to new lyrics. And I think they do carry over into contemporary music and protest music in various ways. Most movement activity since the labor movements of the 1930s and 40s draws on similar themes. It's about sort of humanizing people that are on sort of the lower end of the status hierarchy, humanizing them, putting a face on them, showing and telling the world that they matter. That's what these songs are about. Everything from, worker protest to certainly the civil rights movement, Southern civil rights movement, and it was doing the same thing, humanizing individuals up to even now the Black Lives Matter movement. There was a list that came out in Rolling Stone magazine last year of 22 music anthems of Black Lives Matter, and some of the themes speak to the same issues, sort of struggles against power, community, and cohesion in the face of adversity. These are universal themes, not only within protest in the United States, but really across the globe.
Vincent Rocinio is a sociology professor at Ohio State University and co-author of the book, The Voice of Southern Labor, Radio, Music, and Textile Strikes. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we turn now to the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s and the gospel music that guided those protests. And joining me now is Mary D. Williams. She's a traditional gospel singer and teaches a class called The South in Black and White for college and university students in the Triangle. Mary, what a pleasure to have you back.
It's good to see you, Frank. I'm glad to be back. It's an honor.
Tell us more about this gospel tradition and the way it played a role in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s.
Well, the music was powerful because first of all, we recognized that the songs came out of the African-American enslavement. And so through that, those songs being passed through oral tradition, coming down, I think I talked about it a little years when I came before, how they were passed down. And in doing that, and being passed down, the music had to change lyrically. During enslavement, the songs were coded, they were veiled, and there were certain words that definitely could not be used. When they reached the movement, there was, instead of saying civil rights movement, the word freedom was used over and over and over again. And so songs that were sung in slavery, for an example, I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way, great God, to Canaan land. So when the slaves sang that, that was coded as Canada, veiled as geographically, they're going to leave that location. But during the civil rights movement, the words changed to, I'm on my way to freedom land. I'm on my way to freedom land. I'm on my way to freedom land. I'm on my way, oh Lord, to freedom land. And basically that was an opportunity to build this community, to unite a body of people that had the same thing in mind, that no more geographical locations, we're not relocating. Mm-hmm. We're standing with a commitment that we want changes within our communities. Right here in North Carolina, no matter the town, there was a demand for change, and the music was the foundation and the principle that they used to shield themselves and to really to reinforce their point.
Reinforce the point, as you say, build a community among those who are asking for freedom, demanding freedom, but also reminding those who had the power at the moment that these are shared values. If freedom is something you all keep talking about, and this whether it's religious freedom or freedom from this earthly, right, freedom from earth and heaven, which is the original valence, and then we're mm-hmm. talking more about now freedom within the society, but these still should be shared values. So we're talking about something in common, black and white.
Exactly, which was an opportunity, especially particularly in Highlander when the trainings took forth. You've got college students of all races. You've got them coming in, getting training, and this music was an intricate part of the training. You know, when they would come to Highlander, they were taught and trained how to apply this music, when to use it, how when they were in jail, how that the song was a covering. It was the movement. It was an opportunity for them to stand together, united. And the music had its way of uniting them in such a powerful way. I mean, it brought about a community in terms of when they were even being attacked, no matter the situation. You've got children, you've got all ages. So it was something that unified a body of people for protest while they were marching, no matter the situation.
Talking to Mary D. Williams, a traditional gospel singer and educator who's talking about the history of gospel music and the civil rights movement. And that conversation will continue just ahead on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the history of protest music in North Carolina. We've been talking to Mary D. Williams, who is a traditional gospel singer and educator, and we've been talking about the role of gospel music in the civil rights movement. Talk about the Freedom Singers and their role in all of this, Mary.
Oh, wow. When we talk about the Freedom Singers, we cannot overlook in any way Bernice Johnson Reagan. Powerful. One of the things that she talks about in her book, Don't Hinder Me. If you don't go, don't hinder me. She talks about the potency of the music. She talked about how it comes out of the Black church, how that this was something that whether you were illiterate, no matter your situation, this music was resonant within the community already. So when the music came up for the movement, and they were having the rallies, and they were having meetings within the churches, the music was so resonant with everybody. So they were started. One of the things that she talked about was, and she talks about, there's a song, New Jerusalem, and it's, oh, Mary, oh, Martha, oh, Mary, ring them bells. But when many of the marchers, and they were jailed, they changed the lyrics, and they changed it to, oh, Pritchett, oh, Kelly, oh, Pritchett, open themselves. They use those lyric changes to reinforce, and they actually to reinforce the movement. They use those lyrical changes because Pritchett, Kelly, those were the police officers. They were the chief of police. They were rallying up those that were protesting, and they were rallying them up, taking them to jail.
Well, yeah. I think that's the genius of it, too. And you put your finger on it, but the idea that this comes from a tradition, so it's mm-hmm. who we are. And then you're trying to bring other people along who want to figure out, okay, we'd like to be part of this. We don't share that history. Tell us about it. Well, I could write you a book, or I could sing you this song, and then the real genius is, look how relevant this is today. I change one word and everything falls into place, and it's the same song.
It's the same song. Yeah. And it is, and history is, it's something how we're seeing so much of what was experienced in the 60s. We're seeing it now. Mm. And the songs are relevant. The songs are still relevant today. So, but it was a way of, again, bringing a body of people together to bring about that oneness, because you're talking about people within their own local communities. We're not talking about national levels here. We're talking about regular people that were working day to day, somewhat as you were talking about the previous interview, right. Millwork. These are at home, what my grandma used to say, at home folks.
At home folks with the same concerns those mill workers had. Look,
yes.
I know life is rough, but it's a job, and if I speak up, I'm out. Right. And the idea that we could all, through this music and through other community activism, have a voice and a communal identity,
yeah,
was certainly powerful. You know, I want to talk about bringing it up to date, too, because I'm thinking about the band The Roots, who have taken to this music and have reached back to some of this music. Very contemporary group, but here's the song, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around.
Turn me around, Lord. Turn me around. Ain't gonna
That's the band The Roots performing the song Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around, and that's 2012. I'm talking to traditional gospel singer and educator Mary D. Williams, so that's to your point that this music is still with us, because sadly, the problems are still with us.
The problems are still existing, and particularly when we talk about our community, when we talk about what's going on in African-American community, when we talk about just day-to-day issues, this music still resonates. It's powerful and a powerful force to be reckoned with. And I think one of the reasons it's so imperative that our students, our children know, because if we think back to the movement, we cannot take away from the fact that you're correct. Families, husbands, fathers, mothers losing their jobs if they participated in the movement. Right here in Durham, children, you know, 8 years of age marching from St. Joseph's, you know, the Haiti Center, which is now the Haiti Center, because the parents were afraid that if they got involved, that they would lose their home, they would lose their jobs. But the children made every effort. Yes, we want our freedom. Yes, we want our freedom, and we want it now.
And that activism paid off, at least in the short run. There's been a lot of setback, and we're here today, and we want to talk about that contemporary movement. Layla Noor is somebody who pays attention to that and is doing activism today through music. Layla, welcome back to The State of Things.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tell us now about the I talked about the genealogy, and I know that music plays an important part. Maybe I'll start there with you. How important is music to the activism that you practice?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that I always say is that growing up as I did, poor, black in New York, being Muslim, later coming out as queer, there is so much conflict at every intersection of my identities. Every single one of them is political. And so then later picking up music, that was just very like easily fused into that. And that's definitely something that I bring to my organizing.
What is it now? Are things different these days? I mean, I'm wondering because technology has certainly changed the way we see each other, the way we relate to each other. Music had always been a common bond. Does it work? And I know that you weren't there then, but do you feel like it works the same way? Or what's the impact that it has today? Because you remember, Mary's talking about music that everybody knew, right? They all knew those songs.
Mm-hmm,
and today, it seems to me the environment changes pretty quickly. And maybe the songs that you know, somebody 10 years younger or older than you may not have heard.
Right? No, absolutely. I mean, looking at movements that are happening now, thinking specifically around Black Youth Project, BYP 100, which is based out of Chicago and does have an amazing chapter here. And one thing that I really love about protests that have been uprising now is that, yes, there's been a lot of like chanting, but they've also been coming back to this, like the roots of doing music as protest. And the songs are different. Some of them are these remixes of like, ain't gonna let nobody, you know, turn me around. But then also BYP has one where it's like, I love being black. And they just sing it out with hundreds of people out there. And it's the most magical thing. And so Movement for Black Lives had their big national convening, which is after Black Lives Matter kind of sparked FO's movement. And at their national convening, Kendrick Lamar's song, All Right, that was like the anthem. And it was amazing to see all of these young black folks building on this deeper analysis around like intersectionality, around deeper inclusion of folks, and still being able to like see protest even in these mainstream artists as well, to like take that music as a form of protest.
Give us a sense of the music that you're writing today and how that fits in. Yeah, well, maybe you could. Let's do it that way. Why don't you play a song for us and we'll come back and talk about it. How about
totally.
That?
So this song, I chose to play this one. This is one that I played earlier this year at the Women's March on Raleigh. This song's called 725, which is currently right now North Carolina's minimum wage.
And a colored girl said, do 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 do. And a colored boy said, do 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 do. And my poor people said, do 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 do. 725, 725. How they think that I'm supposed to survive? They spend a half a mil so we don't unionize. While the heat stay off cause the bill's too high. Now gas is on the rise, so I can't even drive. I can't afford to rent, I can't afford to buy. I can't afford to live, I refuse to die on these low slave wages. Why do they hate us gracious? Like they deserve a medal for employing us, when taxpayers are the ones who are supporting us. So what if I don't have a degree? There are millions of people out there just like me. We stretch ourselves thin trying to make ends meet. Gotta hustle for my rent, I hustle just to eat. I hustle when I wake, I hustle in my sleep. It is everything I do and everything I see. Oh, but you call me a lazy slob. You told us get another job. Okay, you could blame it on me when a CEO makes $300,000 a week and I'm drowning my feet in despair and defeat. You're the crown and the king. I'm the jester, it seems that way. For me to get paid, I gotta join the ranks of a dope boys parade. While everyone pretends like I could climb the chain of a system that would rather see me dying in a cage, yeah. So I don't care what you say, everyone deserves a living wage. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace on my streets. I get no justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace on these streets. So get up off my dreams, please. Get up off my dreams. Yo, yo. Wake up, wake up. Bake up. How high can I blaze up? How much space does my blackness take up? How much hate could fill a power-hungry cop, kill an innocent kid, rip a family apart, huh? They say, well, don't act up, but it don't matter if I do, it don't matter if I don't, it don't matter in my school, it don't matter in my home. If I was a king, they would lynch me off my throne, cause black lives matter. What's the matter? Is the matter me? I just wanna get her Skittles in her iced tea. I'm just trying to go home and go to sleep. Yes, I sold a Lucy, please don't strangle me. Dear Mr. Officer, get your hands off of us. Never shut down an Ivy League for an eighth of bud. Never shot 41 bullets in a white girl walking home late night after her hot meal, after the blood spill, after the blue lights, after the kill count is back to your nice life. You wipe off your conscience and fall sound asleep. I dream of the next day you terrorize my streets. I said, no justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace on my streets. I get no justice, no peace, no justice, no sleep, no justice, no peace on my streets. So get up off my dreams.
Leila Noor, the song is 725, and she's here to talk about protest music today in North Carolina. And I can't help but notice the similarity between that and that protest music in the 20s and 30s, where it was a very direct story about what's wrong with that system that
yeah,
you're putting me through.
Absolutely. And it's also like a pretty like do-do-do.
I was going to say, instead of referring to the gospel, you make reference to Lou Reed, but there you go. But, there is at least a reach back.
Totally. And it's also, and what felt important to tie in with this song, and one thing that I notice also whenever I come, you know, because traditionally I've done folk music, a lot of folk music, and whenever I'm doing anything that's hip hop or rap fusion, it always comes out in this really intense political way, which is also so tied into the history of hip hop and rap being such a political thing, that again was speaking to this spirit of like, you're not alone in being angry. You're not alone in this dissenting spirit around wanting to coalesce, around wanting to organize, and even being tempted to grab arms to fight against the injustice that you're dealing with.
Was HB2 a kind of watershed moment for you?
Absolutely. I mean, so as an organizer also, and primarily the organizing that I'm doing is with working class background, working class black folks that have backgrounds that I do. And HB2, I feel like, was something that was such an important conversation starter, because it's something that really it brought to surface a lot of the struggles and the moral challenges that folks have around wanting to fight for everyone's rights, wanting to fight against this big kind of like beast of white supremacy or this system, but then also having their own internal struggles around gay rights, around trans folks. And that was brought up with HB2. It was brought up with Amendment 1.
Well, what about that? I want to talk about this. I haven't left either of you enough time, but Mary, I want to ask you first. Obviously, these are two different styles of music in many, many ways. When we think about the gospel-based civil rights songs, a lot of them had to do with these common values, black and white. These are things that you all should be able to associate with, though it's very particular to the needs of African Americans in that moment in the civil rights movement. But not as direct as what we heard in the 30s and again here, these kind of calling out, kind of finger-in-the-chest accusations. Is there, how does that play out? I guess what I'm saying is maybe this is a moment where, because Moral Monday, we hear a lot more of gospel music and that kind of a throwback to 60s. Are we seeing a moment where all of that is coming together, that this is our common heritage, black and white? And by the way, there's something that you just need to know about how the system works, which is a far more direct form of protest music.
I think so. I think it is. But I think that, too, when you think about the moral climate, when you think of, like, for example, when you think about Black Lives Matter, it always concerns me when we talk about the anger and those kinds of things, because it concerns me when things begin to happen in communities, how that our African-Americans are damaging their own communities, but we keep, you know, we're very concerned about Black Lives Matter, but we're positioning ourselves, destroying our own communities. When we think about how that the black community within itself is not even on the increase as far as babies being born. We have, 500,000 some abortions, black babies. So we've got issues and concerns that really the music that came out of the biblical tradition, that came out of the movement, that came out of slavery, is still, to me, defiant. And it's still in your face, but it's still that message that we're trying to steal, that we're going to continue to push and continue to hold on to, that, you know, I'm not going to let anybody turn me around, and that there, that these things are not, some things are not even in comparison to being black or civil rights as far as being black. It's just that the choices that are being made.
Layla, well, how do you see this, too? Yeah, in terms of whether these musics are coming together, because there do seem to be two different audiences. Mm-hmm. One is to rally us and make sure that we are very clear about what's at stake here. And another is maybe sort of across the bridge, a hand across the bridge. Is there an inherent conflict in these kinds of music, this sort of protest?
I personally don't believe there's a conflict. As a person, and again saying, when I first started doing music, it was very, it was folky, and it was more so around what the what I felt like the audience needed to hear, whereas now I feel like it's so much more apologetic.
Mary D. Williams and Layla Noor, both guests on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for listening. I'm Frank Stachow.